This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 1st, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 398, coming to you from the Web Summit 2025 podcast studio here on Level Zero at the Vancouver Convention Center. It's the first time for Web Summit in Vancouver. It's a gathering of thousands of innovators, investors, instigators, influencers from around the world. And here we are, and here you are. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. And later I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, we've got the usual headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And of course, the big deal feature is all about what I saw this week at Web Summit 2025 in Vancouver.
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
In less than a year, the Vancouver Convention Center will host the 76th FIFA Congress. In just over a year, the FIFA World Cup 26 is coming to BC Place Stadium in Vancouver and 15 other cities across North America. Three leaders of the FIFA World Cup 26 organization spoke on May 28th at Web Summit in Vancouver. In order of appearance, Chief Tournament Officer for Canada, Peter Montopoli, Chief Tournament Officer for Mexico, Jürgen Meinke, and Amy Hopfinger, the Chief Business and Strategy Officer for FIFA 26.
And so the sporting landscape has changed for us. We were always the number one participation sport in Canada, team participation. I think we will always be. We're 40 to 50% more than hockey, and when I say that, people are always surprised, but it's not surprising to us when we look at the fields on every weekend and weeknight. So the sport was on participation track, and now we've taken it to an excellence track with our men's and women's teams. I see the sport taking another jump like it did in the last 20 years to the next level, where we are continually competing against Mexico and United States within CONCACAF and the rest of the world. And it's up to the team to prove that at the Men's World Cup, but more so about humanity, how inviting we are to the world, how celebrating we are of diversity. And that's been a core pinning of our bid when we started with the United States and Mexico, that we had to show the world that we are about celebrating humanity and we're welcoming. And I think when we put together all the FIFA fan festivals that the city of Vancouver is doing and non-host city FIFA fan festivals, we'll see the celebrations in every community and every pocket within the community. I think we will all feel the sense of pride of our country that maybe we haven't felt for a long time. Yep. And maybe we need it more now than ever before. And I think the FIFA World Cup will be the catalyst to bring that, and I think that's the legacy for us as Canada. America.
For Mexico, it has been clear that the legacy of the 2026 FIFA World Cup will go further along than just the game itself. Why? Because we hosted it three times already. The penetration of the game, it's number one, number two, number three, and then something else. It has been really identified as a brand repositioning exercise. And I like to put myself into that example when I explain what the federal government, state, and as well as municipal governments have understood and have aligned themselves in how we're building this World Cup in Mexico. I've lived outside of Mexico for the last 25 years. Every time that I turn on the television, I see news about Mexico. I see a lot of negative news about Mexico. The tragedies, the bad things that happen in our country, which are factual, they are happening in our country. But it's focused on that 5% of negativity that the world is now remembering Mexico. If I talk to this group of people here, to us, and I say, what's your first thought of Mexico? You might think about those images of insecurity and bad things happening down there. And while that's a reality, Mayor, it's only 5% of who we are. The other 95% of Mexico, history, culture, tradition, food, music, in addition to new synonyms that might not have been related to Mexico as a country or as the three host cities, which are inclusivity, modernity, openness, a country of opportunity for investment. Before we came on stage, Mayor, we were talking about a stat that I read this morning that Mexico has become the second largest American expat place in the whole world, just after Canada. And I think we might be fighting for that first spot. Those types of things are the opportunities that the federal government are trying to seize on so that the world sees that other 95%. Yeah. The World Cup football becomes an unfiltered platform that allows the world to consume that other message that is Mexico. And they have doubled down. They want to offer that. Now, the only way that you can offer that is by delivering the tournament with an operational excellency like nothing else. Because this opportunity starts with a stadium and a football and 11 versus 11. So how do we deliver that with operational excellence competing against other 13 cities around North America that are excellent about putting events? That is the key. And from there on, how you build on the other narratives. How do you allow your media members that land in your country and that are covered the games on match day minus one, match day and the day after? Mm-hmm. What else do you give them? Those stories that are going to go into your own, you know, people, culture, how do you give them that content? We talk about technology content. How do you give them that? And that is what Mexico has doubled down. This is an opportunity to reposition the brand of a country and three cities to the entire world.
So we've seen the opportunity that these major events bring, both from a professional standpoint in those two examples, but also just participation. So you look at participation grows year over year in the United States from a soccer perspective. It is not the number one sport in the world. That is what our goal is here. Our goal is to continue to make sure that soccer reaches every corner of every city in the United States. And with that, the World Cup brings that opportunity. It brings the participation, it brings corporate investment, it brings community investment, which is really what we're here for. So as Canada and Mexico and the U.S. look at the opportunities of the World Cup slightly differently, ours is a continued escalator of growth.
Just so you know that the Breaker.News asked to interview Jürgen Meinke and Peter Montopoli from FIFA 26, but the requests were denied. The Breaker.News will keep trying to get you the answers about the costs, the benefits, and the impacts of the biggest tournament in sports history coming next year to the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Media executives appeared on the Web Summit Center stage in Vancouver on May 28th to discuss tech and readership trends in the beleaguered business. Zachary Carabel of the Progress Network moderated a discussion on trends in the news business. In order of appearance, San Francisco Chronicle editor Emilio Garcia Ruiz, Axios executive editor Kate Marino, and Jennifer Cunningham, editor of Newsweek.
I want everyone here who still receives a daily print newspaper on their doorstep to clap. Thank you so much for your contributions. You run a daily newspaper, which also, of course, is a web product. How do you think about that? Is there still going to be an actual newspaper in 10 years? How do you balance them out? How do you deal with the fact that 17 people clapped?
So when Jeff Bezos bought the Post, where I was working at the time, on his first day, everybody wanted to ask him that question. You know, Jeff, how long do you think print is going to be around? And this was now, 11 years ago, 10 years ago, he bought the Post. He told this little story that has turned out to be 100% true, which is print is like horses, to which we all said, what? Print is like horses. There was a time when everybody rode horses to get to work, when the horse brought the ice, when the carriage was, horse and carriage was the main form of transportation in the country, and that's no longer the case, but people still ride horses. And so that's what print is going to be. For a select group of people, the people who clapped back there, print will be a expensive option that will go on as long as that audience exists, and horses have been continued to be ridden for hundreds of years after they were no longer the primary form of transportation. But it's a very small part of what you do at a regional publisher now. 95% of the time is digital. You're focused on the news of the moment. You're focused on doing really great enterprise and investigative and accountability work of your local government. And you're focused on the big thing in journalism now, which is utility. How do you make people's lives easier? I don't know how many of you live in the Bay Area, but life in the Bay Area is a series of complex regulations. Basically, you need permission to mow your lawn. And so we do a lot of work in the utility space, and we find that those three areas help us attract a lot of digital subscribers. We're now north of about 150,000 digital subscribers, which makes us one of the most successful regional papers actually in the world right now.
So Kate, Axios comes along in the past decade plus. It's like this revolutionary form. You're gonna do like very short little things, and Deep is gonna be 2 minutes longer than the 1 minute that you take on the Axios thing. And now it's this entrenched model, and it's established, and you're like the old new media. You're like the you won the last battle. So, like, what do you do now that that model is entrenched? But then there's all these other new, you know, quirky startups. Plus, you've got legacy media seemingly, frustratingly, refusing to die. So, like, what do you do about that competitively?
Yes, you are correct. We are entrenched, certainly, in the sense that a lot of people have done variations of copying our writing style, which is called smart brevity, and it includes some bullet points and some catchy phrases like why it matters. But you see those a lot now. I think for us, what it comes down to when we think about our audience, like Jennifer said, trust. I mean, trust is kind of the buzzword in our industry right now. Like, do we have it? Did we lose it? How do we get it back? Like, is it irreparably gone? But trust, engagement, and AI proofing are kind of what we're obsessed with. And one of the ways that we still try to maintain and build trust is sort of an old school way that we first launched with, which is that we deliver a lot of our journalism via newsletters. So you have newsletter writers who have kind of a daily relationship with their readers, and it doesn't need to be the most gigantic audience in the world. If it's an audience that you build trust with, you have a daily relationship with, that is good for the readers, and it's good for the business, you know, in terms of if we're thinking about the business side of it and advertisers and who they want to reach and how, that's very good. And then why would they be even having this daily conversation with any of our reporters? We're very focused on the AI proofing concept, which is let us give you something you cannot get from an AI. So the commodity news, the breaking stuff that everyone's going to have, I mean, somebody can do that and maybe is making money off of it, or we'll figure out how to do it, but that's not our focus. We are very obsessed with giving you the original reporting, the scoops, the analysis, the different way of thinking about something, the kind of conversation driver of the day, and that's the way we think about AI proofing. So I guess, I hope that answered the question, but those are a few ways that we think of trying to push our audience relationship forward.
So that's a perfect segue into the AI portion of the conversation. I want to direct this one toward Emilio because it kind of reflects some of what he's in. There was a Best Books of the Summer list generated by about 2-3 weeks ago, and two of the books were the must-read books of the summer, which came out in the Chicago Sun-Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, was a book by Isabel Allende, a very famous Chilean-American novelist, called Tidewater Dreams, which was described as a first-class climate fiction novel, and a book by the Percival Everett, who won the Pulitzer Prize this year, called The Rainmakers, which is reportedly a near-future American West where artificially induced rain has become a luxury commodity. Great idea for a book. Problem is, neither of these books exist. And the list included, half of the books on the list don't exist because it was an AI-generated list. So, like, what do you do about, how do you, first of all, I mean, you can answer this and you can answer this about the AI proofing, because this was also done by a human with AI rather than done by AI. So, like, what's going on here, man? I mean, I want to read those books, but apparently that can't happen.
Yes, that's obviously a terrible mistake where AI went awry and the person using the AI, we're owned by Hearst. Hearst has a subsidiary, King Features. It was their publication, and we've accepted full blame for that. I will say, though, that if you're as old as I am and you've been around digital as long as I have, you know that every digital advancement comes with setbacks. And it is really important that every company here keep like a certain amount of money in the piggy bank to use when the day the new technology goes bad and you deal with it and you admit it and you face it and you move forward. I think the danger for our industry is actually what we've done before, which we've always been afraid of new technologies. We were terrified of Snapchat. Oh my God, TikTok, the Chinese are gonna steal all our data. Facebook, it's gonna be... We need to not do that this time. We're going to make mistakes, learn from them, and move forward. And that, I think, is what every company here is going to do. There will come a day when the AI gets you, I'm sure, for everybody here. But you need to move forward afterward, not make it change your company culture and become afraid.
So how do you deal with this, particularly given that you do it? You know, you do a lot of online content. You do a lot of tweets and blue sky, whatever.
Yeah. So I'm an AI evangelist. Newsweek, I'm proud to say, was among the pioneers of an innovative approach to AI integration in the newsroom that's ethical, as well as transparent. And we're strong believers in AI-assisted journalism that is human-led. So I'm going to say that again, AI-assisted but human-led journalism. So if something goes wrong, if we have to, if the AI has hallucinated or there's some sort of error, you know, that's not the AI's fault, that's our fault. And we need to be, you know, we're proactively checking and making sure that whatever content is being published has been checked by at least three humans so that we are very much taking accountability around our use of AI and also doing it in a transparent way. We use AI for a couple of different operations in the newsroom, but we're really trying to utilize an AI in a way that frees reporters up to do the things that reporters should be doing. They should be on the phone. They should be in the field. They should be getting court documents. And the more administrative tasks, we are deploying artificial intelligence to help us to go faster.
And so you mentioned like an AI, you know, scrub or sort of making sure, like how does that work for what you're doing at Axios?
We're very obsessed with experimenting with AI. A lot of it is kind of not reader-facing. It's a lot of workflow processes and research and cleaning data and, you know, stuff like that. We don't yet produce anything that goes to readers with AI. Anything that we do with AI behind the scenes, though, it's the same thing. It's like double, triple check by a human. I think the big question is, at what point in the future does AI become so good that people feel like they don't need to do that double and triple check anymore? And how do we know when we're there, and what do we do at that time? I think that's kind of the big question that everyone is dealing with right now. But right now, it's like, oh, wow, did you see that crazy thing that ChatGPT told me when I asked them this question? Like, we all sort of know that we need to double and triple check everything. Most of us do. But I definitely, the way that we've seen how quickly the technology has advanced, I think the bigger, more existential or more critical question is when that changes in the future.
2 leaders from the anti-corruption organization called Whistleblower Aid held a May 29th news conference at Web Summit in Vancouver. CEO Libby Liu and co-founder Mark Zaid spoke about the current authoritarian environment in the United States under Donald Trump's second White House term. Libby Liu is a former executive with Radio Free Asia and founder of the Open Technology Fund, which funded creation of the Signal encrypted messaging app. You've probably heard about that in the news in recent months. I asked Libby Liu about the evolution of the Signal app, which is popular among journalists and whistleblowers alike.
I think nothing's more important than the free press and the ability to get accurate and uncensored information. One of the hallmarks of an authoritarian regime is state-controlled media. And that can be direct, for example, CCTV or China Radio International, or it can be indirect. And authoritarians have shown us many, many ways that they have co-opted the media. Media's got to stay strong, it's got to stay pure, you got to do your job, and you know, we work closely with our trusted media partners to make sure that the pressure from these giant corporations and from the US government, the President of the United States, will not interfere with the truth. And nothing is more important than giving each individual the ability to make informed decisions about their own lives. I think that's critically important.
Hi, Bob Macklin, the Breaker.News here in Vancouver. The trends that you're talking about happening in the United States are also happening up here, but not with the same velocity, and there isn't one point person as there is in the US, of course, with Trump. But we're seeing attacks on whistleblowers, we're seeing destruction of public records, we're seeing disobedience of public records laws, we're seeing governments not keep records when they should be keeping records of important decisions. And to that end, Signal has been an important method or tool for whistleblowers to reach journalists and to provide documents, to provide information. Now we're seeing Signal be used by the highest levels, you know, Pete Hegseth, for instance, and here in Vancouver, Mayor Ken Sim, who brought Web Summit to Vancouver, was caught by the Integrity Commissioner at City Hall here using Signal to hold secret meetings of City Council. So what are your thoughts on this very important tool built for a very noble purpose being turned around against the public and against the media?
Okay, so I would say that Signal doesn't take any position, right? The only thing it is designed for is to protect the content of your communications with each other. So to that end, every project, the Open Technology Fund, gets security code audits every year just to make sure that the thing is safe. And our philosophy when we created it was, you know, obviously everything the Open Technology Fund created was to protect the digital lives of dissidents, activists, journalists, you know, the people that authoritarians wanted to spy on. I think it's still serving that, and the philosophy was that if we got massive users, then the people most at risk, you know, democracy activists and things like that, would get hidden in the masses, right? Because it used to be in the first few years, if you had Signal on your phone, you were doing something sketchy, right? But now everybody has Signal, everybody's using it. There are bad users and there are good users, but that's not Signal's job. Signal's job is to make sure that what you communicate with each other is private. And to that end, if you use Signal, please don't use it without disappearing messages. I mean, otherwise you've defeated the purpose. Your digital security is only as safe as the sender and the recipient. So always keep that in mind. We don't control what people do on Signal. We just try to make sure that nobody can get the content once it's there, including Signal. Signal doesn't have any access to your content.
But in both countries, the power is with the people to hold the government accountable, not the other way around. And obviously the use of Signal or any other personal device, we've had this, and I'm sure Canada has had it too. We had it in both in Democrat and Republic administrations, the use of personal devices, personal emails, personal cell phones for work-related conversations that were then not preserved. And of which in the United States, and I imagine there's probably something similar in Canada, where record preservation laws require the government to maintain these records for a period of time so that we can get access to them later on to see what our government has been up to. So that continues to be a real problem. One thing that we'd love to do at Whistleblower Aid at some point as we grow is to branch out into other countries to do the same type of work, because what we do is needed in every country around the world. It's not anything unique, of course, to the United States. I guess I'll end and say I'm behind the times in programs that I watch, but I'm watching Handmaid's Tale now, which is probably not a very positive thing to watch at the time, if you know the story, because it feels a little bit too real. I'm reminded in the program how Canada is the home for us U.S. asylum seekers in Handmaid's Tale. So for those of you who are Canadian, do not become our 51st state. Stay free.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
And it's time for Around the Rim on the Breaker.News podcast. I'll take you around the Pacific Rim for some of the hot news headlines that I found this week around the Pacific Rim. First in focus, Taiwan.tw. COVID-19 cases have doubled in Taiwan, marking a seventh weekly surge, according to the Taiwanese Center for Disease Control. Yes, COVID-19 is still with us. Over 40,000 people sought medical treatment for COVID-19 in Taiwan from May 18th to 24th. That was more than double the previous week. The Taiwan Food and Drug Administration said local manufacturers have reported production of rapid test kits is expected to reach 460,000 kits this week and 620,000 kits next week. The Epidemic Intelligence Center blames the spread of the new variant, which is called NB.1.8.1. That's NB.1.8.1 if you're keeping score at home, and hopefully this does not become a household word in North America. In ABC News Australia, whistleblower protections have failed superhero Richard Boyle. Calls are growing for urgent reforms. More than 8 years after the former Australian Taxation Office debt collector internally spoke out about heavy-handed debt recovery practices, Boyle has stopped fighting for justice. Boyle pleaded guilty to four charges for disclosing protected information, making a record of protected information, using a listening device to record private conversations, and recording another person's tax file number. The 49-year-old struck a plea bargain to avoid jail. The case has reignited calls in Australia for better whistleblower protection. In Kyoto news, Japan okays a reserve fund used to curb energy bills amid inflation. The Japanese government decided May 27th to allocate the equivalent of $2.7 billion from reserve funds for the current fiscal year to subsidize the energy bills of households and businesses during the summer. The relief measures were unveiled last month to counter the impact of hefty U.S. tariffs, including a 25% levy on Japanese cars. Critics claim the measures are aimed at building support for the government ahead of elections this summer. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregon Journalism Project, a family sues after heat-related death at Bend, Oregon Senior Care Facility. Staff left a heavily dressed Lenore Hess outside on a blazing August day. Her family seeks $12 million in damages. The lawsuit names Aspen Ridge Retirement Community and Dallas-based Frontier Senior Living. It's one of the nation's largest chains for senior citizens' homes. It was nearly 37 degrees Celsius on August 30th of 2024 when caregivers allegedly neglected the 76-year-old. In the Washington State Standard, yum, you can now take home some roadkill to eat if you're in Southwest Washington. Good news for people who enjoy deer, elk, and saving money. Who can argue with saving money? A lot of people could probably argue with having some deer and elk on their plate. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife will allow people to take home and eat deer that is killed in motor vehicle crashes in three counties. That's Clark County, Cowlitz, and Waukegan counties. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Judge who will decide fate of Surrey Guildford election result wants to start hearing as soon as mid-June. And FIFA executives speak at Web Summit 2025 in Vancouver before the one-year countdown to the 2026 World Cup. Of course, that's coming to Vancouver and Toronto and Seattle and 13 other cities in Canada, U.S., and Mexico in June and July of next year. And actually, the Vancouver Convention Center will be hosting the FIFA Congress at the end of April in 2026. So in one way or another, the World Cup really starts sooner here in Vancouver. And of course, we've been covering a lot of the buildup towards the World Cup on the Breaker.News podcast and the Breaker.News and BobMackin.Substack.com, and we'll continue to do so.
That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar.
Now it's time for the Virtual Nanaimo Bar on the Breaker.News podcast. Every week we end the podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people that keep campsites clean and safe and natural here in British Columbia. June is RVing and camping month here in British Columbia. And did you know that camping and RVing contributed directly $1.7 billion to the British Columbia economy? And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Just email me, bob@thebreaker.news. So that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the 1st of June in 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 1st of June in 1980, cable news network went on the air, better known as CNN? It was inspired in part by BCTV in Burnaby, British Columbia. Bet you don't know, the first CNN newscast was anchored by a husband and wife duo, David Walker and Lois Hart. So now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. You can find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. And that's where you can sign up for the free email newsletter. You can get updates to your inbox, or you can also follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. And as a special bonus for subscribers, you get the podcasts ahead of everyone else. So thanks very much, and thanks from the Web Summit 2025 here at the Vancouver Convention Center, and thanks to the people behind the controls here at the Vancouver Convention Center. So I got Noah and Vivian. So thank you to Noah and Vivian for helping record this for posterity, for helping me get this to you. And thanks to the people here at Web Summit in Vancouver.
Until next week.